On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We're really honored today to have Dan T. Carter, University of South Carolina Educational Foundation Professor Emeritus, author and editor of more than 40 scholarly articles and 7 books that include Scottsboro, A Tragedy of the American South. He has received 8 major literary prizes, including the Lillian Smith, Bancroft, and Robert Kennedy Awards, as well as a special citation in nonfiction from the Mystery Writers of America. His newest book is Unmasking the Klansman, The Double Life of Asa and Forrest Carter. Dan T. Carter.
No relation.
Yeah, I'm glad of that, because Asa or Forrest Carter is not the sort of guy that you want to claim for your family tree. The book is with New South Books, which is now an imprint of the University of Georgia Press, and you can check out their website, ugapress.org. Dan, thank you very much for the extraordinarily detailed book and for all the research that you had to do, at some of which was pretty dangerous, and for making time to talk to us today on the Bookshelf.
I'm delighted. As I told you, my son teaches at Auburn, and I've heard the Bookshelf several times, and when you called, I thought, yeah, this is something I'd really like to do. Thanks for calling me.
Oh, absolutely. Now, this guy, Asa Carter, we probably can say that people, this is the biggest racist you've never heard of, although you have heard his words before, and that's one of the things that makes him such a fascinating and dangerous guy. The two examples that I got from your book that are probably the most likely to be known, one was the inaugural speech of George Wallace when he became governor of Alabama, his infamous statement about segregation then, segregation now, segregation forever, came right out of the pen of Asa Carter. But also, in his new identity as Forrest Carter, the outlawed Josie Wales that was turned into a successful movie with Clint Eastwood is also from his pen. So this is maybe the most dangerous kind of racist, someone who is good with words. He was not well-educated, but he seemed to have a real knack for writing things that people wanted to hear.
Well, he certainly was a very good writer. Like a lot of people who may not have that much formal education, I mean, he graduated from Oxford High School outside Anniston, did a year of study at the University of Colorado. It's his native ability, and the fact that he read so extensively, mostly in far-right literature, but also just in novels, it's clear that from an early age in his life, when he was in his 20s, he was already writing at a level that most people don't reach. Yeah, he was quite talented. There's no question about that. I became interested in him because of that very first speech you mentioned when I was trying to find out who actually wrote, because at the time that I was working on my biography of George Wallace, there were several people who claimed they had written it, but it quickly became clear when I interviewed Governor Wallace's closest aides that the whole thing was written by Asa Carter, who by that time was so notorious that he was really Governor Wallace's secret speechwriter. But he became a critical aide of Wallace all during the 60s. He had a secret office in the Capitol. Actually, was most of the advisors I talked to of Governor Wallace said he was the person most influential in getting Governor Wallace to persuade Mrs. Wallace to run as governor.
I teach journalism and communication at Troy University, and I'm in the Lurleen B. Wallace building on campus that was erected after her death. A lot of strings back and forth.
There are. And he really admired Mrs. Wallace. He didn't realize she was always very polite with him, as she was to everyone, I think. But privately, she found him not to her liking. I know when he tried to write her inaugural speech, she turned around and said, "This is not me," when he tried to repeat the kinds of things that the Governor Wallace had said in 1963, and he very obediently rewrote it to reflect her personality. There are many interesting cross currents with him and the Wallace administration and with what went on in the 1950s. You're right, he is certainly not well known, but actually in the 1950s, He was well known before television news, but in the 1950s, Fox Movietone News, at the end of the movies, on the weekend, you'd have a week summary of the news. And he appeared 7 times in this national program, broadcast all over the country. He developed a radio network, which for a brief period of time had about 14 radio stations, mostly in Alabama, but also in Mississippi. He was interviewed by the New York Times, by Nation Magazine, and by a number of national writers. So he's one of those sort of second-tier segregationists of the 1950s who we forget about, we did forget about. But he was a force to be reckoned with in the 50s.
He went into the Navy in World War II and was apparently the sort of traditional racist that Southern whites often were, especially in that time, and didn't think anything about it. But there were influences on him while he was still in service that seemed to make him go further and further away from the normal casual racism that was common during Jim Crow to being someone who absolutely lined up with the most radical views about black folks. And since he got involved eventually in the Klan, that included Jews and Catholics as well. So who was the biggest influence on him in that first big bend from being just sort of a casual racist to being really a dedicated one?
I'm not a psychologist, and I'm very hesitant about making judgments based on the reason that people make decisions. But I think it's very clear, when he graduated from high school in 1943, in May of 1943, he was so talented in his high school and so well-known, an athlete, top of his class, that he was admitted into the Naval Officer Training Program. And that fall, when he was studying in the program at Mississippi College, he flunked out. And it was a bitter, bitter disappointment to him. And it wasn't because of his intelligence. It was because he'd gone to a small high school in Alabama, 11 grades, and he didn't have the kind of math background that was essential for the Navy officer training program. But I have to believe from what happened from that time on that it embittered him and made him more susceptible. He was always very ambitious to approaching things in a, quote, intellectual way. And he got in the Navy, and he, on his troop carrier ship in the Pacific, there turned out to be a group of about 12 to 14 young, mostly seamen, who were studying a right-wing character named the Reverend Gerald L. K. Smith. Now, Smith is not very well known today, but in the 1930s, he certainly was. He ran for president. He established a very, very widely sold magazine, The Flag and the Cross. And he was, Gerald L. K. Smith was one of these individuals who combined neo-Nazi ideas. He worshipped Adolf Hitler. And anti-Semitism, racism, and an emphasis on what he called a white Christian America, that the only really way that America was going to survive was to make sure that only white Christians were dominant in the society. Smith backed away a little bit from Hitler once the war started, and certainly after we learned about the Holocaust, but his ideas really ignited something in Carter, who began reading widely in this far-right literature, mainly from the 1930s, the Bund, what was called the German Bund movement. Although it was tamped down after the war, as I said, mainly because of the discovery of just how awful the Holocaust was, these ideas didn't disappear. And although Carter learned to conceal, for the most part, his anti-Semitism, he had viewpoints about race that were much more, I hesitate to use the word sophisticated, but they were certainly much more elaborate than the average white Southerner had at the time. He saw it in cataclysmic terms, a worldwide struggle between Aryan peoples, Christian people, mainly Northern European extraction, versus a dark, colored world that was dangerous. He was notoriously not only anti-black in the United States, but he was also anti-Latino. he talked at a time when not many people were talking that much about Mexican immigration as it was at the time. He railed against that as diluting Anglo-Saxon Aryan blood. So yeah, he developed a really extraordinary kind of set of ideas, which we might describe as a little loony today, but they certainly weren't just sort of off the wall. And that's what's so striking, too, about that inaugural speech in 1963, because all we know about it is that it was segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. But if you actually read the entire speech, which Wallace, I don't think, read but a few hours before he delivered it, it's a much more elaborate explanation of white Christian nationalism and the dangers of colored people around the world. And newspaper reporters just didn't pick up on it because it seemed so off the wall. And at the time, it was such a minority view that they, they just sort of ignored it. But it was there.
He goes through a lot of different experiences to get to the point of coming to Alabama, including going to University of Colorado for a time where he fell under the influence of a professor, being on the radio and doing commentaries and being able to talk openly about his segregationist views and about anti-Semitism and so forth. Always bothers me that there was apparently a great deal of anti-Semitism in the United States that was very open prior to World War II. Something to do with the Ku Klux Klan, where they embraced anti-Semitism with the idea that the Jews were part of an international conspiracy with communism, which, if you've ever read it, how the Jews got treated by the Russians or the Soviets, then you'd know that's ridiculous, because unless they were doing the very best job of covering them, making it look like it, they consistently went after Jews.
And some people did. You know, Jews, particularly in the American South, have had a very complex kind of history. On the one level, there were a lot of Southern Christians who, of course, didn't believe that Jews were saved, but they did respect them as was often called the people of the book. And they recognized the fact that Christianity grew out of Judaism. And on a practical level, in many communities of the South, Jewish immigrants who had come into the United States in the 1880s, 1890s, and afterwards, many of them gravitated toward the South. Every major department store in Birmingham was Jewish-owned. Many of the leading Jews of larger Southern cities, Charleston, Mobile, Montgomery, even Birmingham, were often actively involved in civic life. One of my favorites is the rabbi of the largest temple in Birmingham taught at the Baptist College. He taught Bible study, Old Testament Bible study.
And who better?
In Hebrew. Yes, right. And so it's a strange thing in which, on the one hand, there is an audience clearly for this notion that Jews and communists are manipulating blacks. It all fed into the notion that blacks were so ignorant that they couldn't do it themselves. You had to have these money-grubbing Jews who were manipulating them for the purpose, which always struck me as equally absurd. I mean, supposedly these capitalist bankers were in league with the with communists, which did seem a little strange. But
yes,
there are ways in which you can balance contradictory views like this. So it did strike a resonant chord with some of his followers. But a perfect example of how complex was that, for the most part, when he was a radio announcer in the mid-1950s, he tried to focus on blacks. But in one radio broadcast in the spring of 1955, veered over the line and began talking about Jews and their involvement in civil rights and so on. Well, even though he was very popular, the group that had hired him wanted to keep him. A group of actually mostly Christian businessmen in Birmingham who worked closely with their Jewish counterparts, they were the ones who said, this guy's got to go. We can't have this. The irony, he always acted at times that the Jews had done him in, but actually it was Christian businessmen there. So that's what I mean about it being such a complex story. Maybe that's why the book is too long. I tried to tell too much about it. I also think because it's an unsettling book.
Yes.
But I've tried to keep the momentum going so that you want to turn the page and find out, this guy's a weird character, but what happens to him next?
Yeah.
Where can he go from here? And the truth is, he goes in strange places,
that's the truth.
As you discovered when you read it.
Consistent accusation that the NAACP and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and other civil rights organizations were infiltrated by communists might go back to the Scottsboro Boy trial, where the American Communist Party did kind of take up the cause for their own purposes. But that was about the only time the communists were ever involved in any sort of civil rights stuff. Seems to me that by the 1950s, they had no interest in it. Although in TASS, the Moscow newspaper, they like to bring up the fact that America, which claimed to be a place of freedom and all, still treated African Americans, or Negroes as they would have said then, badly, not as second-class citizens at best.
Yes.
Which was true.
Absolutely. And I do think there was a very practical reason why a lot of... I'm sure people convince themselves. It doesn't take much if you really see somebody as the enemy to describe all sorts of evil manifestations of them. But there was a practical reason as well, and that was in the 1950s, anti-communism, and the fear, in some cases rightly so, of Soviet infiltration of our atomic energy program mm-hmm. and their attempts to spy within the United States led to a kind of semi-hysteria that we call McCarthy. And for Southern segregationists who were under, they felt they were under siege, as national views may not have become egalitarian, but outside the South, there really wasn't much support for legal segregation. And so a lot of Southern segregationists seized the communist issue because it gave them some common ground with Northern conservatives who were equally concerned about communism in the United States. So you're right, there was not much going on in Alabama. I mean, I remember when I was a college student at the University of South Carolina, and they had one of these un-American activity committees for the state, and they brought in this one guy in Spartanburg who was an avowed communist. When they started asking about all the communists, he said, look, I don't make any bones about it. I'm a communist. He said, you could take every communist in South Carolina, we'd all fit in one telephone booth, he said. And I think that was probably true in Alabama as well. But it became a very powerful weapon to be used against the civil rights organizations.
Of course, we could probably talk for an hour at least about the book because there's so much information in it. But I will say that one of the things that we trace in this is, first of all, the rebirth of the Klan after such things as Birth of a Nation reinvigorated the Klan. That's when they added the Catholics and the Jews to the list of people they didn't trust. By the 1950s, there are some Klan groups. There are lots and lots of Klan groups. Few of them are very big, but there's lots and lots of groups. Asa Carter decides that the Klan groups that he knows are not really active enough, so he puts together what he considers to be like an A-team or a Green Beret of racists.
That's a good description.
Yeah, one of the things that I never thought about was because of the mining industry in and around Birmingham, there were plenty of men that had access to dynamite and knew how to use it. And this is one of the reasons that Birmingham earned the sobriquet of Bombingham. There were so many bombings, not the least of which, of course, was in 63, but there were bombings all through the 1950s, which I had never heard about.
Yeah, and it actually goes back even to the late 40s. And initially, it had much to do with blacks as they got better jobs in the mining industry and the coal and steel industry. They began looking for better housing, and they tended to move into the edge of working-class white neighborhoods, and that's where the bombing originally started. But by the 1950s and into the 60s, it was mainly against civil rights activists, King and others. There were a number, and of course, the most infamous of all, the 16th Street Baptist Church. What he wanted to do was, he didn't have much use for the Klan groups that existed. They weren't intellectual enough for him. Partly, but he wanted to operate on two levels. This guy really studied communist tactics. He read a lot of communist literature about how to organize, and from that he learned the sort of manifesto, which you got to operate at two levels. You have one semi-respectable level, and that was him as head of the North Alabama White Citizens Council. But you also need a strike force. You need people who are willing to secretly engage in violence. And that's when he formed the Confederate Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Their very purpose was to engage in violent acts. You know, he gradually accumulated 150 or 200 followers. But that went south when a gunfight broke out among them. That's the only problem. You recruit guys like this, and everybody's packing heat.
Yes.
They got in a dispute. But he never gave it up. He formed a small Klan strike force, which engaged, they attacked Nat King Cole when Nat King Cole was performing in Birmingham. He was on the stage singing. They attacked a civil rights minister. But the worst, and the one that actually proved to be his undoing as Asa Carter, came in 1957 when his followers, his strike force of five followers, randomly chose a black handyman and castrated him as a warning to blacks to stay in their place. And this guy amazingly managed to survive. They left him for dead, but he survived. And five Klansmen, or at least the hardcore members, were sentenced to long prison sentences. But they refused to rat out Carter. As he always did, he stayed in the background, he told them what to do, but he didn't take part himself in these activities. And that, again, is very much part of the how the communists organized, and to make sure your top people stay out of harm's way. And he learned from that. But on this one was everybody, even though he wasn't convicted of it, the newspapers made it clear that these were his followers, and they were acting on his behalf. That sent him underground in the late 50s and led to his secretly becoming Wallace's speechwriter and advisor. But it was secret. He didn't appear in public in the 60s.
I find it absolutely amazing that the courts actually convicted these guys who castrated this poor man, because most of the time, if they got convicted at all, which they hardly ever did, they got off with a slap on the wrist. But these guys got sent to jail ostensibly for 20 years, although later on, apparently, when Carter was in with Wallace, he managed to make sure that they got let go early with early parole. Not a huge surprise. The surprise to me was that they got convicted at all, because that almost never happened.
I think it was, but and I don't want to be cynical about it. I think the particular one of the, I interviewed one of the policemen involved, and he was genuinely horrified. So he said, I was a segregationist, but he said, this is beyond the pale. I think the judge in the case in particular made it even worse, was that the guy they chose to engage in this brutal assault, which left him crippled for the rest of his life, was an Army veteran from World War II who had never been involved in civil rights activities. He was just a hard-working black guy, worked as a painter and handyman, and I think it was also a chance for the judge and the prosecutor to say, look, we're not monsters in the South. I know you think we are. And those guys, essentially, I think that's the reason they got very long sentences, even though they didn't serve very long.
We're going to jump over a little because we're almost out of time. Quickly, tell us how this virulent racist, with the FBI watching his every step by this point, ends up finding a way to recreate himself and didn't even change his name that much. Just adopted his first name, the last name of his hero, Nathan Bedford Forrest, and turns himself into a Native American author and a successful one at that.
You talk about happenstance. In the first place, I do think it was easier, and he did this in 1971-72. He bought a place in Florida, and he told his lawyer, the battle is over. I've lost the battle for segregation. I'm going to make some money. And I think that's exactly what it came down to. He became very cynical about the whole thing. He spent his whole life struggling for the white supremacy, and he saw it as kind of drifting away, and so his response was, okay, I'll make money. He goes down to Florida. He spends 3 months walking on the beach, getting a dark suntan. He was always kind of swarthy, black hair, and then he goes to Abilene, Texas, goes into a bookstore, and he always introduces himself as a Cherokee American. He wears a cowboy hat with a feather in it and bolo tie with a turquoise thing, and it's a reflection of a more innocent time, I think, that nobody questioned it. And he was such a charming con guy. Everybody I talked to, everyone loved him. They talked about how much fun he was, how he was so charming and could regale you for hours with funny stories. And he quickly made a network of friends and acquaintances out there and began speaking. But the book thing was the amazing one. He printed up a copy of It's called Gone to Texas, but it became The Outlaw Josie Wales. I know how hard it is to get published. And certainly for a 48-year-old guy who nobody ever heard of before, how do you get a major press to do this? And so he sent out copies of this privately printed book, and it ended up purely by chance in the hands of a woman who worked for the William Morris Agency, which represented Clint Eastwood. She read it and thought, this is good. And Clint Eastwood is going to love this book. And he did. He immediately signed him up. And once he got that contract with Eastwood, then Doubleday, a major publisher, signed up the book, and he was off and running through two more novels and a fake childhood story about growing up as a Native American. And all during that period, it must have been stressful, because any time somebody could have outed him, there were lots of people in Alabama who knew who he was. Heck, he appeared on the Today Show, millions of people watching, and he managed to convince Barbara Walters that he was just a good old boy, Indian, Cherokee American, Texas boy. It is a tribute to his skills as a con man and an actor that he was able to carry that out during the 1970s. Unfortunately for him, I don't know what would have happened, but he had always had a drinking problem. It went back Navy. He had all kinds of problems with captain's mess, but being drunk all the time, and he controlled it much of the time. But I think the stress really got to him in the 70s, this double life, always fearing somebody was going to expose him. And by 1978-79, he had published these four books, but he was really a full-blown alcoholic by then and not really functioning very well.
And that was close to the end of his life.
Yes, 1979, yeah. He dies summer.
This is a guy who reinvents himself, but he never really changes. It's the same guy when he's masquerading that he was when he was operating and keeping a low profile under his real name. And that's the saddest thing, because one of the Klansmen that is mentioned in your book, actually, when he got to prison, converted to Orthodox Christianity, ended up becoming a pastor of a multiracial church in Washington, D.C., and so forth. I interviewed him a couple of years ago when his book came out.
Yeah, he's a pretty amazing guy.
Yeah.
He really was.
That when I started reading your book, I was hoping that was going to be the end of this story, too, and was and was sad to see that he never really, as smart as he was, he never really understood and never really got the fact that he was absolutely wrong about his prejudices, and he never was able to overcome their hold on his heart and soul.
I wish he had. It would have made the book much more satisfying. I mean, we all love an arc of redemption.
Yeah.
I wasn't even sure until I interviewed a couple of people who knew him at the very end of his life. One woman who knew him extremely well, and she didn't know who he was. She thought he was Forrest Carter. She knew him. She spent hours with him. She said he would be totally not like that. But then when he had a few drinks, out it would come. Yeah. And she would try to talk to him about it. And the week before his death, they had dinner together, the last time she saw him alive. And, they were in a restaurant. He was drinking. She was trying to get him to stop drinking so much. And a black couple came in, and he literally began railing about Jews and blacks so loudly that she said, I'm sorry, I have to leave. And she got up and left. And that was a week before he died. So clearly there was something that was awry in his life that he never was able to see. I think partly because he lived in such a controlled environment. I mean, his nephews, niece that talked about him, and his sister-in-law, he lived in this very kind of closed enclosure as far as ideas were concerned. He never allowed himself to be threatened at all.
It is a real cautionary tale of how it's easy to fall into a pit you can't get out of if you don't really want to. And such a fascinating story. Can folks go to a website and learn more about the book or more?
Just go to the University of Georgia Press and click in Unmasking the Klansman, and it'll give them some details. I want you to go to your local bookstore if you can, South in Montgomery. I'm sure stocks the book and others. But if you have to, you don't have a local bookstore, it, of course, is available on Amazon.com with the description of the book.
Dan Carter, our guest today. His new book, Unmasking the Klansman, The Double Life of Asa and Forrest Carter, from New South Books, which is an imprint of the University of Georgia Press. And once again, their address is ugapress.org. Thank you very much, Dan. It's been a great honor to talk to you.
Really, thanks. As I said, I'm a great fan of your show, and I'm just pleased to be on it.
We'll see you next week right here on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com and your favorite radio station. You can check our website, wtbfradio.com, to hear this show all this week. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening. God bless.